I'm Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, and because this program works, I've been sober since January 1st of 1973. We do that in Texas. They say that if you don't give your sobriety date, you probably don't have one. So, being told that, I use it. It's great to be here. We were so excited about coming, we got here Tuesday. There being nothing to do, we went to see Yosemite. And you have got a beautiful state, and that's just a spectacular canyon that you have there. And those trees, gotta love those trees. That grizzly giant, 2,700 years old. It's just awe-inspiring to stand next to that tree. And think about how big a problem that I have today, and what a dent I'm going to make on life, how well I will be remembered. I'm many things, like all of you. I'm a recovering lawyer. My recovery date from law is January 1st, 1998. My sponsor is Frank, who quit practicing law a little before I did, so I can... Follow his footsteps. I'm the adult spouse of an Al-Anon. I'm a victim of Al-Anon brutality. I've had a tough life. I want you to know that. Mostly I'm an alcoholic, though. When I tell you I'm an alcoholic, those of you who are also convinced of that fact for yourselves, and I have a common bond, which is the most useful tool ever found for helping one alcoholic get sober, one at a time. That's the way we all got here, one at a time, one drunk working with another. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not convinced at all that alcoholism was any kind of a disease. I was pretty well convinced that I was some sort of a moral leper, that I just, was a wimp. I couldn't understand why, what had happened to me. I once was able to drink a lot. I couldn't drink anymore. I was in trouble everywhere you could get in trouble, it seemed like, and I just heard you all talk about it being a disease or an illness, and I didn't really identify with you. You told me, in fact, that I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows. And I want to tell you what, I felt like I was sort of unique, but I did not want to be bodily and mentally different if it meant the way I drank whiskey. That was not in my agenda at all. But that's really the fact of the matter. I have a condition. I don't care what you call it. But today, looking back on my life, I can tell you that I have this twofold condition. One part of it's physical. When I take a drink of whiskey, it goes to my stomach and something happens. You hear it described as a warm feeling, a big boom, all kinds of things. But sooner or later, if you're an alcoholic, your body will tell your mind, I think we'll have another one of those. And another one, and another one, until we've had too many. It has another component to it, and that's mental. We have an obsession. An obsession is a great big thought. It's so big it pushes all the other thoughts out of your mind. And my obsession was, a drink would make this situation better. Now, the situation could vary. It could be a wake, a wedding, a fancy ball. It could be almost anything. But I would have the thought that a drink will make this better. Now, when you combine that obsession with a physical condition that causes you to say, I think I'll have another drink, you've created a problem in your life. And all of you know that. I like to describe alcoholism. I was raised on a farm out in West Texas You talk about this being agriculture anonymous. I know about agriculture. I know about good crops and bad crops. And we didn't have any walnuts. We didn't have a lot of nuts. We had a little grain, but not a lot of nuts. Not nearly as many nuts as you have here. Told my wife as we drove in here today, I'd never seen as many nuts in my life. But I wasn't going to say about anything about it until, what, Clarence, was that his name? I had a dog. And this dog had an experience that helped me describe alcoholism about as good as I can any other way. My dog's name was Patches. He was mostly an English bulldog. He was a hero. Patches had fought a badger. The badger weighed 1 pound more than he did. We know that's true because we weighed the badger after Patches finally killed him. He was respected. The whole community heard about that fight with that badger. And to give you a little bit of a hint of Patches' character, he would go up in the field where he fought that badger and killed him and pick up that old carcass every day for about a week and just shake the bejeebies out of it. Just to let that badger know that if reincarnation worked or whatever, you come back, I'm here, you're going to have to deal with me, you know. This particular Mormon, though, he was a hero. He was well fed. He was well loved. He had no competition. He was lying in our barnyard. He had not a problem in the world. There weren't many problems in that barnyard. Nothing was going on. Dad was working in the shop. I was doing whatever kids do. And Mother was in the house. All was quiet. All was peaceful. And into our yard came our neighbor's boar hog. Big, ugly hog. Long, yellow tusk. He just ambled in the barnyard, and Patches made a bulldog-like decision to get hold of the hog. He went sailing into that hog, growling and snarling. He got hold of the hog. The hog began to squeal. Dad came running out of the barn. He was out there cussing, kicking hogs and dogs, trying to get that thing broken up. I saw my dog going into that deal, and I went sailing out there trying to get him out of there. Mother saw her kid going into that fray. She came running out of the kitchen. Everybody had a problem. We all had a problem, and we all knew the solution to the problem. Patches, turn him loose. Turn him loose. Let him go. Well, Patches didn't do that, but he came off after a while. And when he came off, the old hog wheeled around there and just laid his shoulder open with one of those tusks. And Dad was able to catch him in that instant. Picked him up snarling and snapping and carried him over to the water hydrant and ran water on him, sent me to the barn to get some pine tar to put on to stop the bleeding. The dust settled. Got quiet. Dad got him patched up. We turned him loose. He went right back and got hold of that hog again. Same deal. Barking, snarling, squealing, kicking, cussing hogs and dogs. Kids in there, wife, my mother's in there trying to get it all settled out. Everybody knew the solution to that problem. Hog knew it. We knew it. Everybody knew it. Patches turned him loose. Well, he didn't turn him loose. He came off again, though, and Dad caught him this time. And this time, we recognized that Patches was not himself. I think the psychiatrist among us would say that Patches' emotional nature was in charge of his intellect. That means you're crazy as hell if you don't know. And when that's happening, what do? You commit them. So we got a chain and we tied Patches to the water hydrant. And we cooled him off, gave him a little water therapy there. And Dad got in the pickup and drove the hog off, removed temptation. And I was appointed his counselor. And I sat with him and I talked to him. Asked him deep and penetrating questions. Patches, have you ever had a good day getting hold of hogs? What does your family think of your getting hold of hogs? And, you know, I had 2 hours, I had him cured. Dad was back at work, and everything got quiet. He was laying on the ground.
He had that little short tail that was working a little bit, you know. His tongue was hanging out, and he had that bulldog smile on his face, you know. He was loose and easy and comfortable. So I went to see my father, the warden, and I said, "Dad, Patches is okay." Dad made an inspection tour of his own because he'd had a little trouble with Patches that day. And he went around and scratched his ears, and Patches was glad to see him, and he was wagging his tail, and everything was calm. Everything was cool. So Dad said, "Okay, turn him loose." And I turned him loose. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog this time. Can any of you identify with anybody in that story? I personally was one of the first hogginons in West Texas. A little later on, people began to tell me to turn loose the hog. Turn him loose, let him go. Don't do it as much, don't do it as often. Do it in a different place. You'd be a better man, a better father, a better lawyer, a better whatever it was if you just didn't drink the way you drank. And it seemed like to me that drinking was the problem when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Just like it seemed like getting hold of that hog was that old bulldog's problem. But you see, that wasn't the real problem. We stopped him from getting hold of the hog for a while. We all stopped drinking for a while. Maybe it's a matter of hours, but we stopped sometimes. The problem was what sent him out there in the first place. What sent him back again and again and again in the face of absolute certainty that he had hold of something that he could not handle. Now, I don't suppose Patches ever knew he couldn't handle that hog. Because a few weeks later, he tried the same kind of trick on a cattle truck. And he just caught one cattle truck. We got guys out there, and boys and girls and men and women out there today that are catching cattle trucks. We don't all get here. And our problem is not turning loose of alcohol. Nothing in our book tells us how to stop drinking. You just stop putting it in your mouth. That's the first good way to do it. And you don't put any more back in there, and that's the trick. How do you avoid putting it back in your system? How do you avoid drinking? And our book tells us we have to radically change ourselves. We have a series of steps that puts us in touch with a power greater than ourselves that puts us in a place in a universe where drinking alcohol is not necessary or even desirable. I didn't think that would ever happen for me. I like to drink. I don't know about you, but some of you may have been force-fed. I wasn't. I didn't like the taste of it to begin with, but I always, always liked what it did. I liked who did it. I liked where we did it. I liked what we did when we had it. I liked it all. I liked the mystery of drinking. Where are we? What did we do? Those were frequent questions that I heard or asked. And we'd have to piece it together. One guy could remember a little here and another one here, and that's the way I started drinking. And I liked that. I could get positively excited about getting drunk a week from tonight. Man, it's going to be good. Well, it might be bad, but probably going to be good. And we'd wake up and go through those series of questions. And I was always the guy that said, while I was looking around for another beer or a little bit left in the bottle, "Let's do it again." Wasn't ever going to give that up. Had no plans to give that up ever. And then life went on with me. And I did the things that you did. I got out of school, and I went to work, and I got in the Navy, and I got married, and I had children, And all through that period of time, I drank. I kept drinking. And drinking was used by me for almost everything. I used it for good times. I used it for bad times. I used it as a tranquilizer to help me sleep, to get me up in the morning. Whatever it happened to be, I used alcohol. It became the center of my life. And I was just like you are, or just like you were. I really didn't know that alcohol had me. I didn't know that I was owned by the demon alcohol, that Mr. Ms. Gallo owned me. I had a lot of ways that I hid that from myself. I always found something else that caused the problem. And I got in trouble within weeks after I started drinking. I wound up on the band bus in college. I'm not in the band. I don't play any instruments. I was the only one on the band bus. And the dean of the college wanted to know why I was on the band bus and why I got sick on the band bus. And I told him, I lied. I just said, well, I was at this football game and suddenly realized that some virus was striking me and was very sick, and I started trying to get to my car, and I just couldn't go any further than that band bus, and the door was open, and I crawled on the band bus in that last moment of consciousness and got sick, and somebody found me there. Worked. So that set up a pattern, you know. It was always something else, an excuse. Went right on through marriage, and we had kids, and I was a responsible guy. I worked hard. I was a person that was, I thought achievement was the number one thing in life. I needed to achieve something. I didn't have it now, but I could get it. Whatever it was going to be. Money, a car, a house, a wife, kids, whatever it happened to be. Something was going to fix me, but it never did. And I kept chasing it, and I used alcohol to take little vacations because of all the disappointments I had along the way, because I could never get there. I could achieve things, but I could never quite get it. And I was not going to give alcohol up. Alcohol I liked. I was a heavy smoker. Another good example of my way I rationalized and justified what I did. I was a heavy smoker. And I was an automatic smoker. I couldn't get so drunk that I would lose my cigarettes and my cigarette lighter. They always wound up beside me wherever I went to bed. And I could wake up in the middle of the night and feel around for my cigarette lighter and my cigarettes, and I'd find them. And I'd light one up, and I used that little light. One of our presidents talked about little points of light. Well, I had a little point of light that helped me go around and look for restrooms and things like that in the middle of the night. It wasn't a big light. Didn't always work. Did you ever notice what a similarity there is between a closet and a bathroom? But I would find my way back at last to my bed, and I don't know about you, but drinking made me tired toward the end. And I'd kind of lay back on the pillows and going to finish my cigarette. And now, I was married to a woman. She's here. This is my wife, Billy. She looks good, she's got a nice smile, she's pretty, but she overreacts. She overreacts a lot. And there were times when little sparks would leave my larger spark and fall to the blanket and burn tiny little holes in the blanket. And she would overreact and get very excited about those little burnt spots on the blanket. And I explained to her, there's nothing to get excited about here. That's why we have that pretty coverlet that goes over everything in the morning to cover those little flaws up in our bed. And she bought that until one morning I woke up, well, one night I guess it was, there was a pretty good sized fire going on my side of the bed. It's difficult to explain that. The best explanation for it, if it ever happens to you, is just tell them you think it was on fire when you got in there. We managed to get the fire out, and you know, there's a lot of people talk about the miracles of this program, about how they now intuitively know how to do things that used to baffle them. I intuitively knew things then. The moment I opened my eyes the next morning, I knew intuitively that I needed to get the hell out of that house right away. And I did, and I told my wife, buy any kind of bed you want, and I left. And that night, she overreacted again. She wrote me a letter. I was coming home. I don't know why she needed to write me a letter. She said, Dear Jerry, I've been talking to you about your smoking and drinking. I've now reached the point where I can no longer go to bed at night without worrying about the lives of my children or my own life. You must do something about your smoking and drinking. I told you I was responsible. I did. I quit smoking. Never thought about quitting drinking. Never even occurred to me. But I blacked out on almost a nightly basis at that point in my life, kept a full pack of cigarettes on my night table, and never smoked another cigarette. Took a lot of willpower to do that. So, there's something more than willpower to this thing, I think. I kept rationalizing and justifying what was going on in my life, the pressures that I had to bear, the work that I did, the problems I had at home. Whoever was talking to me got a different story about why I drank the way I drank. I always had a reason, always had an excuse, and I guess I believed them myself. And then my wife overreacted beyond all reason. She did something she didn't check with me about. She didn't talk to me. She went to Al-Anon. She had been going a long time before I even had a hint that this was going on. I was looking for her on one occasion, and I asked my daughter, who was a little girl then, I said, "Where's your mother?" And she said, "Oh, I don't know, Daddy. She may have gone to one of those meetings." And I said, "What meetings are those, Karen?" And she said, "I don't know what they are, Daddy. They're family meetings." Well, to put this in context, at this point, my wife and I had agreed one day when I was sober that if our marriage and our life together did not improve in the next 6 months, we'd get a divorce. And we were moving along into the 6 months period, and it occurred to me as a lawyer that if my wife were going to family meetings or anything called a family meeting under these circumstances, I probably needed a representative present at those meetings. And so when she came in, I asked her about the meetings. Well, I didn't actually ask her about the meetings. I just started to find out what I could. Now, I tried lawsuits for 40 years. I cross-examined all kinds of people. My wife is the most difficult witness I have ever cross-examined. If she does not want to give you information, it's virtually impossible to pull it out of her. The conversation went something like this. Where have you been? Out. Out where? To a shopping center. Which one? At Preston Road. What did you do there? Oh, I met some friends. Who were they? You wouldn't know them. What did you do there? Well, we just discussed our experience, strength, and hope. And that's the way it went. And so I began to narrow the field and close doors and narrow the field and getting tighter and tighter where she had more and more trouble evading my questions. Finally, I got a word out of her that I had never heard before in my life. Al-Anon. Al-Anon. What would be an Al-Anon? Things were rather tense at this point in our little conversation. And I didn't want to appear ignorant, so I made a guess. The best guess I had was that Al-Anon must be some sort of aluminum kitchen utensil. Maybe she was going to work. It isn't, and it wasn't then. But when she told me what Al-Anon was, it opened the floodgates of information. She ceased to be difficult to get information from. She gave me a lot more information about Al-Anon than I ever wanted in my life. It just poured out. It was wonderful. Al-Anon was wonderful. People would pay $500 a seat just to go to Al-Anon if they knew how good it was. They were warm, wonderful. Everyone was welcome. All you needed to go to Al-Anon was a friend or family member who had a problem with alcohol. I am the entrance ticket to Al-Anon. That's what I am. I've been tried and convicted of alcoholism and haven't even been asked a question, you know. She's taken my problem to public meetings. I've just been made a senior partner in my law firm. I'm the youngest senior partner in my law firm. I have a tenuous hold on that position. And she's going to these meetings, and I can just think of thousands of people. Judges' wives, other lawyers, their wives, clients, their wives, witnesses, jurors, thousands of people who could walk into one of those Al-Anon meetings and see her there and know instantly that she thinks I'm an alcoholic. Now, it's more serious than that. We, in my law firm, already have two alcoholics. We have a full complement of alcoholics. They don't want any more. As a matter of fact, they don't want those two. They're going to get rid of them just as quick as they can. I've heard them say that. And here I am barely getting my foot in the door, and my wife is going to those meetings, and I sobered up right away. I got sober right that minute. And I sat her down in a chair and I gazed deeply into those blue eyes and I said, Billy, we have a real problem here. Do you know that I'm the only one that brings money to this house? She said, yeah. Yeah. I said, do you know that we owe money on the house and the cars and the furniture and all that stuff? Yes. Do you know that if we stop paying, they come get those things? Yes. Do you know that if they find out I'm an alcoholic, they'll kick me out of that law firm, the money will stop, they'll come get all this stuff, and we're not talking about children's education now. We're talking about you and the children and I standing naked on the streets of Dallas in the middle of the damn winter. That's what we're talking about. And she just looked at me, and I said, you must stop going to those meetings. And she said, I think I need to go. And I said, please do not go to any more of those meetings. And she said, I think I'm going to go. And I said something like, well, if you go to another one, I'll kill you as sure as hell. And she went, and I didn't kill her. But I could never get it out of my mind. Every day I went to work, I thought, is today the day they're going to call me in and say, you're out? Drove me crazy. Didn't stop me from drinking, but it drove me crazy. Made me drink more, I think. One night I tried to scare her out of Al-Anon. I tried to beg her out of Al-Anon. Tried to do everything I could. One night I was going to pick a fight with her. And I chose this night to get all my ammunition, all the facts I could get her to admit first before I ever let her know there was a fight going on, you know. So I walked in the kitchen and I said dinner smelled good and gave her a little kiss and asked how the dogs and the cats and the kids and everybody was. And I said, Billy, I've been thinking. And she said, yes. And I said, you think I'm an alcoholic? And she said, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, well, that's damn funny. You've been calling me an alcoholic for years. We've taken tests and everything. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. It's really hard to get a fight going when they're acting like this, I'll tell you what. She said, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what your boss thinks, the doctor thinks, the kids think, your mother and dad think. It doesn't matter whether what anybody in the world thinks except for one person, and that's you. Because if you don't think you've got a problem with alcohol, you'll never do anything about it. And I made a very basic mistake for a trial lawyer then. The mistake I made was asking a question when I didn't know the answer. I said, well, if I wanted to find out, how would I do it? The jaws of the Al-Anon traps closed just like that. She had me. She very calmly said, well, they tell me you could just quit drinking. But I don't think you want to do that. But they say you could take a little test. You could try some controlled drinking. I'd never heard of that either. I said, what is that? And she said, well, you just drink 2 drinks a day. Every day for 6 months, no more, no less, just 2 drinks a day. And I said, you've been trying to get me to quit drinking for years. And she said, that's right. And I said, are you now asking me to drink for another 6 months? And she said, yes. And I realized I was dealing with somebody who was very seriously ill. And I was not going anywhere in this conversation. I was not getting any answers I anticipated. And I got the hell out of there. And I sat and I thought about that thing. And I worried about being found out. And I thought about it. And I drank and I thought about it. And finally one day, I decided maybe I better try to take that damn test to get her out of Al-Anon. Now, at this time, I'm drinking about a quart of whiskey a day. And I don't know anybody else that's drinking that way. Matter of fact, I've been meaning to cut back one of these days when things kind of settle down. And so I decided, well, somebody's going to have to make a sacrifice to save this damn family. Looks like it's going to have to be me. So I decide I'll take the test. Now, I don't tell anybody in the world that I'm going to take the test. I'm just going to start taking the test and let her observe it, and she'll notice it. She knows how much I drank. She counts them, you know. So I started taking the test. Now, I had to change the test a little bit. 2 drinks didn't do me any good at all. I just didn't need any. 2 drinks didn't do it. But I had a pretty good-sized glass, and I could do 2 big martinis before dinner, eat, switch to a big brandy, and then finish the evening off with coffee. That's the way I'm going to do it. Nobody could fuss at me for that. That's totally reasonable. That's civilized drinking. So I start trying to do that. Now, our book talks a lot about reality. I was not living in reality. I lived in the world of delusion and illusion. I thought, this will pose no problem for me. I can stop if I want to stop. I can moderate if I want to moderate. Started taking that test, and it brought me in touch with reality. I'd have 1 drink, and my shoulders would begin to loosen up a little bit. The music would start. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Up from the ashes I would arise, you know. Begin to think about what I was going to do to those people downtown that harassed me that day. Then I'd drink the other drink, get about near the bottom. I'd think, well, that's about all the martinis today. And then it would happen. Our book says alcoholism centers in the mind. And I would have a thought. And the thought would go something like this. What are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who has to go out and fight those other damn lawyers and clients and judges all day long to support this family? Are you going to go out a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey?
answer was, hell no. No, by God, I'm not, and I'd go drink the bottle. Or I'd walk up to the bar at the end of a hard day, and I'd say, ain't going to be no test today. And I'd drink the bottle. Or I could forget it. Some days I could forget it for a day or two. But Al-Anon. Al-Anon. Even when they didn't even know I was taking the test, they were working on me. Her sponsor told her the moment she awakened in the morning, the second she became conscious, to say out loud, this is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it. Now, when you've had a quart of whiskey the night before, and one of your eyes is propped open and you have what I call dry socket, you know, you have that thick layer of fuzzy-like material on your tongue. Your head is, your heart's up here in your head somewhere, bang, bang, bang. And you hear that. When you hear those words, you know with reasonable certainty that you're not going to rejoice a hell of a lot that day. And you wonder, why did I do it? Why did I do that? I decided, sober, that I'm only going to have 3 drinks. What kind of a man is there that can't decide he's going to have 3 drinks and just drink 3 drinks? And the longer you don't drink 3 drinks, the harder that question becomes to answer. You can alibi about it for a while. You can do all sorts of things, but ultimately, the answer is I don't know. Something is wrong with me if I can't do that. And the reality comes home. I gave the test a fair chance. I ran it 1.5 years. Never passed it once. It whipped me like nothing has ever whipped me in my life. It's a remarkable test. The more you cheat on it, the harder it is to pass. It's a bear. If you're an alcoholic. And I was. The last day I drank was December 31st, 1972. It was a good day. I didn't have to work, didn't have any pressure. We weren't having a fight. We're going to have some people come over that evening, and we're all going to go out to dinner and come back to my house and celebrate the New Year. I knew why they're coming to my house, because I'd already been out once in December. And when I got out and got drunk, I was hard to get home, and so we're just going to go out and have a little to eat and come back in. On my feet, functioning a little. I could be drunk, but I just needed to be up and around. And I paced myself carefully. And I remember waking up in my green chair. And I looked out the window. It was pitch black. I looked over at my wife, and she was wearing her robe, reading a little book. I said, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go to dinner? She said, oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is? It's 10 o'clock at night. I knew that she'd call those people and said, we can't go. And by the way, you can't come to our house either. Probably she told him, Jerry's drunk. And I was sick of me. I didn't have any excuses. Reality set in. I walked to the bar and got my big glass, and I had me a great big drink. God willing, that'll be the last drink I ever take. My recovery started from that reality. I got up the next morning, and I sat there on the side of the bed, and I thought about the night before, and I remembered what I'd done and what it was like and how I had disappointed myself, my friends, my wife, how I was a disappointment everywhere I looked. My life was absolutely bankrupt. Oh, I had a lot of things in my life. I'd achieved a lot, but nothing was worth anything. And I thought about what I could try to do this next year that would be different. And the only thing I had not tried was to stop drinking entirely. Something I'd promised I would never do. And I decided that morning that I would try to do that. And I needed to tell somebody. See, I'd never told anybody about the test. My wife didn't know about it. I was even taking the test until I'd been sober about 3 or 4 years, and I made a talk and told about it. The quiet, secret world of the drunk. Lonely. That's why we're lonely. We think we're... No one knows. We can't let people know what's going on in there.
And I went in the kitchen and I told her that I was going to try to quit drinking, and she just hardly looked around, you know. I told her I was sorry first, and she didn't look around. Then I told her I was going to try to quit drinking, and she looked around at me a little bit, and she walked over to the bookcase and picked out, just happened to have a copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Strange coincidence, you know. A little 24-hour day book, and she gave me those. She said, you may find those helpful. Would you like for me to call somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous? And I threw the books against the wall fairly close to where she was standing. Said, hell no. And I'm a West Texan. We're self-reliant people. Pioneer stock. By God, the Lord loves them and helps themselves. You know, that kind of thing. I told her I'd get it. If it was going to get done, I was going to do it by myself. If I got myself in this mess, I'll get myself out. And she said something loving, like, you got it, and walked off. And I had it. I had really had it. The wheels came off right away. I didn't last 2 days. I couldn't get comfortable. I was shaking and shimmying, and I was real quick, you know, looking around and jerking. And if I was inside, I ought to be outside. If I was outside, I ought to be inside. I ought to be sitting down. I ought to be standing up. I ought to be laying down. I ought to be moving. I got to go. And I'm just moving and grooving. Can't sleep. Sweat. It's the middle of the damn winter, and I'm sweating all over, you know. And second day, I decide, well, I better sneak in there and see what those AA and A people do. Read some of that literature. And so I knew she'd leave it in the kitchen somewhere. And I caught her in the back of the house, and I rushed in there, and I grabbed the little 24-hour day book. Sorry it wasn't conference-approved literature. Just had to read something quick because I didn't want to get caught. Opened it up, had a date on each page. It was January 2nd. I went to January 2nd, keen alcoholic mind. You know, we're smarter than most people. And it said, alcohol has ruined your life. And I said, yes, yes, alcohol has ruined my life. It says, this year we're going to give our drinking problem to God and leave it there. I cannot tell you how disappointed I was in that. How are you going to give something to somebody you can't find? I've been looking for God ever since I was a little bitty kid. I can't find Him. I've demanded that He show up. I've told Him I'll live a good life if He'll just show up. Prove Himself to me. I don't want to take a bunch of preacher's words for it. I want Him to show Himself to me. I want to walk on a little water. Have those flowers talk to me a little bit or something. Something spectacular. It hadn't happened. I'd been down to the front and I'd got sprinkled and dunked and all those things. And I'm not knocking that because I think there are a lot of people find God in churches just that way. But it didn't happen for me. It didn't happen for me because I had some other conditions that blocked God from my life. But that morning, I don't know why I did what I did, but you'll hear it happen a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I tossed that little book out in the middle of the table and I said, God, if you're here, or if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. Best prayer I guess I ever said, because I really was in trouble. I was open-minded a little bit. I was being honest with where I was. And honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness are said to be the keys to this program. And I had a little of those and nothing happened. I wanted to drink just as bad as before I prayed. Except the next morning, reality set in again. That day I knew I was going to drink unless I got some help. I needed some help with skin on it. I needed some people. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I resisted everything they told me. Fought them tooth and toenail. From, you know, they said I need to. That lady was. I got a real unreasonable lady on the phone, you know. She said that I needed to go to meetings every day. And I told her I was way too busy. I was an important lawyer and I couldn't do that. And she said, well, what do you do every night? And I said, well, I've been drinking. She said, well, you're going to quit that, so you're going to have some time, aren't you? I said, where would I go? I need to be someplace where nobody knows about me. I got to be secret. Are there some secret groups? And she said, well, I don't know. Might they find you something like that. What kind of group do you want? And I said, well, I have a real small little group. It's close to a country club. College graduates, if you got one. She said, we ain't got none of them. And I knew I was in real trouble. But she gave me a little home group, and I went to the little home group for a couple of weeks, and they had years of sobriety. 15, 20. Their baby had a year and a half. I'm barely hanging on from day to day, and they've got a year and a half. Why, hell, they couldn't have had much of a problem drinking if you had that much time, you know. And then into that meeting one night, after about a month, I went once a month, once a week, whether you needed it or not. And a guy walked in, his name was David. David was shortly before that in a treatment center for a long time up in South Dakota. Something about his unwillingness to take the fourth step or something. But they kept him a long while. But when he came out, he happened to come to Dallas, and he happened to find that little group some way. He had literature sticking out of every pocket. And he knew more about alcoholism than anybody I ever heard in my life. He sat in that meeting, and we looked at each other, and I was still quick. He had 6 months of glorious sobriety, and he was still quick, too. And we sat there, and we listened to one another talk. And we knew that we were looking at real alcoholics. I followed him right out of that meeting. And I said, David, what do you think about this? And he said, oh, that little group? Oh, I said, we're going to have to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, that's fine for those folks. But you and I, we need to get in the middle of it. We're going to have to go to a meeting every day. We're going to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to have sponsors. We're going to have to make coffee. I never did understand what that had to do with it, but I was going to have to make coffee. I was going to have to 12-step people, whatever the hell that was. I said, we're going to have to change the way we think and react to life. And the prayer was answered because I said, where are we going to go? And a guy from South Dakota said, well, I heard about a little meeting out in North Dallas. Just started a little group out there. They meet over the top of a 7-Eleven store. Gave me the address. Said, I'll see you there tomorrow night. I said, I'll check it out. And I did. I cased the place just like I was going to rob it. I went down past that place about 55, 60 miles an hour the first time and just glanced at it. Made a loop, came back by, decided, well, I could safely stop and go into a 7-Eleven. So I went into a 7-Eleven and I looked up to see if anybody was looking out the windows. No cameras, no guards or anything like that were looking down. So that was another good thing. Got me a Slurpee and went back and got in my car. Looked, noticed there was a little driveway around the side of the place. And I pulled in, decided I'd go see what was behind it. And there it was. There it was. 6 parking places in the alley. I could park my car in the alley, climb the fire escape, and go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And that's the way you got me. The man you see before you today is nothing, nothing like the man that stood at the bottom of that fire escape on that first meeting. Scared to death that someone was going to see me. Never went in a meeting that I didn't check quickly to see who was there because it might be somebody that wasn't supposed to be there, and that was somebody that knew me from outside somewhere. Disliked everything you did. Hugged me. People hugged me, grabbed me and hugged me. And I almost hit them to fight them off. You know, get away from me. You know, I didn't want to hug anybody. Boys or girls. Just leave me alone. And they did silly things. Somebody stand up the front of the room and say their name. My name's Jerry. And everybody say, hi, Jerry. It was like a high school fraternity or something. My God. Wasn't cool at all. Told things about themselves that were just incredible. Car wrecks. Convulsions. Divorces. Imprisonment. All kinds of bad things. And every time they told a bad thing, everybody out there just laughed like hell. The most inappropriate sense of humor I'd ever heard in my life. But I'm competitive. I'm a player, by God, and so it wasn't long until I decided, well, I did a couple things kind of cute. I think I'll tell them one. And they said, oh, look here. Jerry's beginning to open up. He's beginning to be himself. You know, that's all you can be. As you sit in that chair tonight, is you're everything you ever can be. There's a part of you can't screw up. And it's here tonight in that chair, and it's all you ever needed in your whole life. To be who you are, living inside your own values. That's what brings you freedom and happiness. And the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous help bring us into reality. To see the world as it really is. That we haven't been dealt such a bad deck of cards. And I met these people when I came to AA, and I was very skeptical. Cynical and skeptical, and I was looking them over closely, and I thought, you know, they're conning me about buying books, and I found it only cost $4.50 or some lordly sum, and I thought you'd never get rich doing that. And so I bought the damn book, and they quoted the book to me all the time, and I didn't know whether they'd tell me the truth or not, so I read the damn thing to see if that's what it really said. And it began to sound like it was me. And they were different. Some of you may have read a little book one time called The Velveteen Rabbit, about a little artificial rabbit that wanted to become real. Well, I was dealing with real people. Unlike any I'd seen since I was a kid on that farm in West Texas. They didn't care whether I had a swimming pool in my house. They didn't care what kind of car I drove, how much money in the bank, what I did for a living. They wanted to know how I was doing with my spiritual life. And I wanted to be like them. And they attracted me into the mainstream of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I became excited. I got to go on 12-step calls. I got to bring people in that, you know, were just a mess. And it was wonderful. We lost that for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. We let them bring to us on buses with little plastic bands around their arms. Many of you drove up that way to Alcoholics Anonymous, probably. Well, I'm telling you what, the buses have gone away. And we're back to ground zero now, and we got a shot at going back to the kind of Alcoholics Anonymous there was when Bill and Bob started. You and I are one drunk at a time all the way from Akron, Ohio. And it was those guys who were out hunting drunks and bringing them to meetings, starting new groups that gave us what we have today. That are the foundation of our traditions and the foundation of our steps. And there's still enough old-timers around that'll help you learn how to do that. And I'll tell you something else. There's a whole chapter in the book, in case you haven't read it, called Working with Others. They'll tell you just exactly how to make a 12-step call. They won't tell you all about it. I mean, it's an adventure. Heard a story one time about a fellow that made a 12-step call, and this old boy, and he had about a 5-day growth of beard on his face, and he was really in bad shape, and he's sitting there with a bottle of whiskey, and stove had some kind of stew or something cooking on it. And he decided he'd try to bond with the fellow a little bit, you know, and get to where he could communicate with him. He said, "You mind if I have a little of that?" And he said, "No, no." So he got him a bowl and got him a little of this stuff. And he's eating it. Wasn't real good, but he's eating it. Well, boy had a dog over in the corner. The dog just started growling at him. He said, what's wrong with your dog? And he said, "Oh, hell, you're eating his food." But you'll find all kinds of things happen out there when you call on those drunks. I got a call one night. It was almost an emergency. I mean, we're talking about serious stuff now. This guy's armed and dangerous. Want two good men to come from Alcoholics Anonymous to 12-step this guy. Would it be a good idea to call the police? No, we don't want to do that. Would y'all just come on over? So we go on over. Two of us. And I'm a little scared when I walk up to the door because I don't know what I'm getting into there. And pretty little redheaded lady comes to the door and looks at it and said, "You guys from AA?" And we said, "Yes, ma'am, we are." She said, "Come on in." And we said, "Well, where is he?" She said, "Oh, now he's standing on the couch." I said, why is he standing on the couch? And she said, "Well, now he's afraid the vacuum is going to eat his toes." So you don't know. But I've never been on one of those calls in my life that when I left it, whether I felt like it was going to work or wasn't going to work, and I never really knew, that I didn't feel like I had been in exactly the right place doing exactly the right thing. I promise you, they never come at the right time either. You're always just about to have something important to do when the drunk calls. But you know that. And it's a wonderful, wonderful experience to be given the opportunity of service. It's what this conference is all about, service. Giving it away. The transition of the steps, I think, this is Jerry Jones's view, is largely a transition from a person who is self-centered. Now, I wasn't self-centered when I got here. As a matter of fact, when I read about that part of it in the book, self-centeredness being the root of our problem, I skipped that because there was no need for me to read about your problems. I didn't need to do that. Later on, I came to recognize that maybe I had a little of this condition called self-centeredness. And I found that my life was shot through with it. I found that every single negative emotion that I've been involved with, from depression to fear to anger, greed, jealousy, name them, they have their core in self-centeredness. And self-centeredness blocks us from the power. It tells us that three times in chapter 5. And I believe it. I didn't have any faith in that power when I got here. I told them I didn't. I said I have no faith. Because I knew what they were going to say. Have faith on step 2 and you'll believe. That's what the preachers had told me. And you can't decide to believe. You can't even decide to have faith. If you don't have it, you don't have it. It's something that has to be homegrown within yourself. They told me, we don't give a damn whether you have faith or not. We don't care whether you think this program works or not. Just do what we ask you to do, and then look around, and you will find that you have had a personal, spiritual awakening, a contact with a power greater than yourself. That happened to me. That's happened to me many times. And when I made that transition from self-centeredness away from that into service, trying to help my fellow man, I got a meaning in my life that I never had before. I could never understand why I'm floating around on this clod called Earth. Why are we here? What are we doing here? Well, I don't know what we're doing here. But I know what my job is here. My job today is to work with alcoholics. I can do that when no one else can do it. So I feel good about that. I have purpose in my life. And I am fulfilled when I do my job. And that, I think, is what we all look for in our lives. Fulfillment. Joy of being. You have those big thoughts that come to you, you know. In different times. I felt sorry for myself when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Had to go to those damn meetings. People would stand up and say, all my friends are in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, my God, what an indictment. All your friends are in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh! What a sentence. I can't go through with it. I just couldn't see how that was ever going to be anything very useful to me. And I felt so sorry for myself. No more taking my clients to nice clubs and buying them wine and those deep dish green olive pies that are called martinis. And it was just a bad deal. And my wife and I were trying to put this marriage back together. And I had maybe 3 or 4 glorious months of sobriety. And I went out to this place in East Texas for a family retreat. It was conducted by a Baptist minister. Now, that shows you how serious I was about looking, you know. We got out there and we had dinner in the Baptist minister. Just about 10 couples. And the Baptist minister said, well, let's get this thing started right. He said, let's just go around the room. Let everybody tell what God's doing for you in your life today. Oh, testimonial time. I was a Methodist. Methodists don't give testimonials. That's private. It's embarrassing to talk about. And I ain't going to do it. Just not going to do it. The problem is I'm sitting in a room. It's got one door in it. I'm on the floor all the way over in the corner. And I'm going to make a spectacle of myself to get up and leave. And she is not going to go with me. She's going to sit right there on the floor. So I figure, well, somebody will pass. Somebody will pass, for God's sake. And nobody passed. We were the only people in AA, I guess. And they began to go around and talk. And, you know, the civilians just don't have any appreciation of problems. They were talking about wimpy little problems like... they couldn't drive the freeways without God. Well, I've driven the freeways drunker than Cootie Brown without God or anybody. They couldn't raise their kids. They couldn't work. None of those things impressed me at all. And I got to thinking, you know, if these people knew that there was a guy here a real alcoholic who hadn't had a drink for 4 months. I guess because some power's helping me. I'd impress the hell out of these Baptists. That's what I'd do. I'd blow the socks off these Baptists. That's what I'd do. They'd want to counsel with me after this meeting is over, probably. I might could help them. So I decided, well, I looked around and I didn't think, you know, I'll never see them again. I won't see these people again. I'll just tell them. Now, I didn't hear anything for quite a while they went around the room because I'm rehearsing my speech. Getting it just right, you know. And just before it was my time, just one couple before it was going to get to me, the old boy got up. He was a big son of a gun. 6'4", 230 pounds, 40 pounds. Had calluses on the back of his knuckles from dragging the ground. You know, you're one of those kind of guys. And he put on the worst spectacle of manhood that I had ever seen in my life. He bubbled, blew his nose, and bawled, and I couldn't understand a word he was saying. I felt so sorry for his wife, I couldn't understand it. Finally, he gave up and sat down. And I was really relieved to get him down. And she got up. She was a pretty lady. She was slender and she had gray eyes like my mother's. And she had a composure about her, almost an aura about her. She was calm. She was at ease. And she said something like, I couldn't do it without God. I couldn't do it without God. He is so, so good to me. And the greatest thing about Him is that He's available to everyone. He'll always be there. And He always makes Himself known to everyone who is in need. She said, my children are ages 2 and 3. And I won't be there to help them find God. But He will be there. And someone will help them. I'm so grateful that said, you saw my husband. He's really having a bad time. But he'll find someone else to share his life with and help raise those kiddos. Because God didn't make any of us where we had to have some other human being in our lives. I'm grateful we've got a good policy of insurance so that I won't be a burden on the family that will continue beyond my death. And I came to realize that I was listening to a young mother, 32 years old, with children aged 2 and 3 who was dying of cancer, an incurable disease. I had one. I identified. I had an incurable disease. I was going to be an alcoholic till the day I died. And I had a great thought. It was almost like an obsession thought. It pushed all the other thoughts I had about feeling sorry for myself out of my head. And it was something like this. It said, ain't you got it tough, cowboy? Ain't you got it tough? You've been sitting around Alcoholics Anonymous sucking your thumb, feeling sorry for yourself for giving up drinking. If that little lady was offered your solution and the doctor wanted to take both of her legs at the same time, she'd said, I'll take it, just like that. Took me a year to recognize that she had the same solution I did. Her problem was just a little different than mine. But it was working in her life. I didn't make a talk that night. I don't honestly know how I got out of that room. I just know I found myself out in the woods, walking around, tears streaming down my cheeks, doing a very unmanly thing. Balling a lot worse than that old boy was. And I was grateful. I wasn't crying because I was angry or sad. God had given me something pretty good. Given me a good life. Given me an opportunity to go anywhere and do anything that I ever wanted to do. And that's happened to me. That's happened to me. I was in trouble in my work. I was in trouble a lot of places. I had a terrible fear that I was walking around with about being found out for being an alcoholic. I thought it was branded, a big A on my forehead or something. I knew that one day, you know, after I got to going to AA meetings, then I really did know that somebody's going to tell one of those partners in my law firm one of these days, and they're going to kick me out of there. Now, I didn't get well all at once. It took me a while to work through the steps and have those emotions get away, and my paranoia took over. I was driving to work one day after I'd been sober for 11 months, and I thought, I know why they haven't asked me about going to AA. They know. They know. They're waiting for the annual partners meeting to kick me out in full view of the whole partnership. That's what they're doing. And I'm a pretty aggressive kind of guy, and I said, to hell with them. I'm going on the offense here. I'm going to tell them and make them fire me before I go to that meeting if that's what they're going to do. So I picked out five that I was going to tell. The managing partner, meanest man I knew at that time. Not a warm, fuzzy person at all. The various department heads, I picked them out. I went to see the bad guy first, and I walked in and I said, I got something to tell you. And he said, what is it? He didn't say sit down and have a cup of coffee. He said, what is it? And I said, well, it is that I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had a drink for 11 months. And I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not telling you this because it's good or bad. I'm just telling you this because you need to know it. If you ever see me drinking again, some of our clients are in trouble. If you ever know of anybody who's got a problem like alcoholism, I think I know a way to help them. And he's one of these guys that just reacts instantly, you know. And he did. He said, I am delighted. My God, we knew there was something wrong with you. We just couldn't figure out what it was. And he sat there for 30 minutes and told me how valuable I was to that law firm. How they needed me. He said, you've noticed we've started sending you work. I said, yeah, I noticed that I was getting a little work again. He said, yes. And he said, you know, I'm impressed with... He said, I'm not impressed with that. I knew you were not drinking. I heard that. But I'm not impressed these guys get on water wagons. He said, they get off and push. But he said, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, that's a bunch that's good. I don't know all I need to know about them, but they're really a worthwhile organization. And when you can say you're an alcoholic and you're going to that kind of a group, the future looks good to me. Now, when I walked out of his office, I could have whipped King Kong left-handed. I knew no fear. And I've never had any anonymity since that time. Being found out about being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, to my knowledge, has never harmed anybody. Now, somebody may confide me a case where it did, but I can show you millions and millions where it did not. And that's the way we get these opportunities to help other people, is to be known in your community. To be known in my law firm, secretaries knew about me, mail clerks knew about me, lawyers knew about me. Everybody knew I was the drunk. They got all kinds of clues. Y'all would call up and say, leave a message. Bob G. called. What kind of friends do you have that just you won't use their last name? Oh, those are my drunk buddies, you know. But my life has opened up. God has been good to me. God has done for me what I could not do for myself. My children and my relationships were in a mess. Today we're very, very close. My wife and I will celebrate 44 this month. She deserves a medal, I'll guarantee you that. And our life has been fulfilled and good, and to have opportunities to come to see people like you and to share with you and to be a part of this wonderful organization is just the most important thing in my life. And I hope that all of you will keep the faith, that you will, when you can, get rid of your anonymity, when you can, look among your neighbors and your job and try to find people that you can help with this disease. The family, send them to Al-Anon. Get a chance. Don't wait for drunks to call. Please don't do that. And, you know, Bill wasn't on the telephone calling around when Abby came to see him. Bob wasn't looking for Bill when Bill came. They were out hunting drunks. That's what we're supposed to be. What we're supposed to do. And don't worry. I hear people say, well, I'm not that far in the program, or I'm afraid I might harm somebody. Don't worry about screwing up drunks. They're already screwed up. Find them and bring them to your meeting. That's where the magic happens. That's where the power is first felt. And grow in your life and be happy. Be all you can be. Let, you know, go for it. Don't hold anything back. Put those steps to work in your life. And I'm going to commit to you that if you keep the faith, I'll keep the faith. And I hope to meet you again as we trudge the road of happy destiny. Thank you so much.